John Williams here. Pete Zimmerman's your producer, as always, and Elise Glink regularly joins us on Mondays. You hear This Week in Wealth with her and Tom Fortino, Sundays at 6:30 in the morning, and you can access all of her wisdom at thinkglink.com. Elise, the markets are not doing too terrible. Everybody reminds us that it's just going to be awful after the first of the year. Recession's going to come, but I'll take 31 on the Dow if I can get it.
Oh, yeah. You might like the way your 401k looks compared to the, the last few months anyway. We've seen, the Dow is up, S&P is up, NASDAQ's up. There's so much green on the board right now. It's all very cheerful. And this is on the back of a kind of a record-breaking week. Last week, we saw the Dow have a wonderful week, went up the most that it's gone up since, the pandemic began, I think.
And it was part of a three-week run, as I recall. Again, we're all playing on a lower playing field than we were. We were at 39. Now we're happy we're over 30, but there it is.
Yeah, I think it's good. We were at like 29, bordering 28,000 with the Dow. NASDAQ was in the nines. And so the fact that everything has gone up, I think is encouraging. But, that said, boy, do we hear a lot of negative news out there, and a lot of people are predicting that it's the housing market that is going to be hitting the skids. And that, of course, impacts all areas of the economy, since housing accounts for about 6 to 7%.
Talk a little bit about that, the housing market and the economy.
Yeah, this is sort of interesting. So people think, of the housing market is how much is my house worth, but it's really how many new homes are we building? How many new buildings are we building? Construction for, commercial real estate, industrial real estate, all the rest. In Chicago, we've seen recently that Allstate's campus, the one that's up in Northbrook, a couple hundred acres of prime real estate, right on 294, that got sold for almost $300 million. And what the buyer is going to do is start to put a huge campus of industrial real estate, huge warehouses right there. It's a terrific location near O'Hare, but also, pretty close to the border of Wisconsin, relatively speaking. But when you think about what you're replacing, which is, a campus of, Allstate, people are employed there. There's other kinds of taxes and things that we get to, get from that. You're replacing it with industrial real estate. It's interesting to see how the building starts to filter into different parts of the economy.
You were also, noticing what percentage of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, so another new depressing statistic, I'm sorry to say. 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Half of people earning $100,000 a year are just getting by. A third of people earning $250,000 a year are basically paycheck to paycheck as well. And this tells you that this is this kind of inflationary period that we're in, with inflation running super hot and interest rates rising, is really hitting people at all ends of the spectrum, John.
A third of the people making $250,000 a year say they're paycheck to paycheck.
I think they need help from my company, Best Money Moves, actually. They're clearly not making some of their best money moves. But yes, we are seeing stress at the upper end. And why is that? Because everybody seems to live right to the edge of their paychecks. In fact, when you look at the 401k numbers, and I know you wanted to look at some of those increases in a moment, just 12% of employees fully fund their 401k. Right? And you've got 70% of people worrying about running out of money in retirement. So why don't more people fund their 401k while they're living paycheck to paycheck? And they either don't understand that there's a tax benefit to doing it, or even with the tax benefit put into the calculation, they still need the cash today to pay their bills. And they don't know how to get around that.
So they're missing probably an employer match then, too, right?
Well, they may be getting the match, right? So let's say the match is the first 4 or 6%, right? If you put in 4 to 6%, then, you would get that match from your employer. But what they may not be doing is going all the way up to the full amount that's allowed. And this year, those numbers went way up.
Elise Glink from ThinkLink Media is on a phone line, and we're just talking a little bit about, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, Elise.
Sure.
You said that While 63% of Americans say they live paycheck to paycheck, a third of Americans making $250,000 say the same. And what percentage of Americans who make $100,000 a year say they can't last past one paycheck?
The survey that we saw this week was 50%, half.
I don't know what to make of that. You know, I think it's very easy to cluck your tongue and judge these people. But if you make $100,000 a year, of course you're going to spend, you know, to the extent of your capacity. You're not making $1 million. I don't know where the line of reasonableness comes in and where you say, okay, now that's on you. But I can understand how somebody making $100,000 or a household with that kind of income who has a couple cars and wants to send kids to college these days, I can understand how they would be financially strapped, for sure.
Well, let me give you some perspective, and I completely agree with you, John. There's no tongue clucking on my end. So back in, I think it was 1990, I wrote a cover story for Chicago Magazine called Scraping By in $100,000 a Year. Now, mind you, 1990, right? 32 years ago. Mm. And, you know, that just back then, I mean, today that would be like scraping by on $250,000 or $300,000 a year, right? So back then, that was a lot of money for people to make. And it was considered that golden amount, the pie in the sky, golden ring. You get there and you're secure. But what was happening, and I think we don't think about enough, is that we were having more and more dual income families, right? People earning maybe the one spouse was earning $70,000 back 32 years ago. It was mostly the man. And the other, the woman might be earning, you know, 30. So 70, 30. Sometimes you'd have a 50-50 split. Well, that just meant that you have increased child care costs, which today, by the way, are just out of sight per child. It could easily be $20,000 a year per child. You've got increased, both spouses are getting to work. They have to pay the transportation costs. They had work outfits that they had to wear because, you know, back then people were a little bit more dressed. But even today, you know, you've got to have some business clothes or even business casual clothes. And so when you start adding up the costs of making it work with a dual income family, you realize that that $100,000 number isn't that much. And I'll also point out that with inflation and the wage increases that are going on, the median income in this country right now is $90,000, really close to 100.
Really?
So middle of the road.
You're right, though. Six-figure salary used to be the sort of thing, well, now you're set for life. And, you know, that's more than the average person makes. That's great, but that's not an end-all, you know. That's not a panacea.
Yeah, it's concerning that we're this close to the median income. And I'll also point out that housing costs have skyrocketed in 32 years, right? It's true that mortgage interest rates had dropped, and a year and a half ago, this feels like a million years ago, you could still get 2.5% on a 30-year loan. And kudos to those who listened and went out and did that. But, you know, if you're actually out and you've got a 4 or 5% mortgage, you're paying a much higher housing cost than you were. Or if you're renting, rents have jumped in the last few years. I think people are really struggling, and they're strapped and feeling the pinch of that, which is one of the reasons why Biden's student loan relief is a really lovely idea if he can get it passed and people take advantage of it. I don't know if you saw this, John, but 22 million people, roughly one half of everybody who carries student loan debt, signed up in the very first week to see if they qualify.
You know, the six-figure sum that you referenced a minute ago reminds me a little bit of $20 an hour. That always seemed to be a golden ring, too. And that's more than $15 an hour, but that doesn't mean all of your financial problems are solved. Let's talk about Freddie Mac, what they're saying in their quarterly outlook about fixed mortgage rates. Where are we going? Are they peaking?
I'd like to say that they are, but they're not. And one of the things that Freddie Mac is saying is they expect the average for this year to be 5.5%. We're over 7% right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You know, 5.5 means we started this year at 3.3%.
Right.
And now we're going to be a lot higher than that. So my guess is that they are looking for somewhere around 8 to 8.5% before things quit this year. Next year, they think an average is going to be 6.5%. What I'm hearing from some housing economists is, depending what the Fed does, if they go up another 0.75 point now and they do another one, you could end up, I hate to say this, you could end up at 9 or 10% for a 30-year fixed rate loan. And I'll tell you what that'll do to the housing market.
That's the forecast for next year, Elise?
It could be as high. There are some economists saying could be as high as 9 to 10% next year.
And I cut you off, and you were saying what about that?
Oh, we're just slamming 60 miles an hour, the housing market, right into a brick wall. It has already slowed dramatically. And we're seeing that continue. It'll go even faster if interest rates climb like that.
Okay. Well, you and Tom will have plenty to talk about at 6:30 Sunday morning. Tom Fortino, and you can always read more from Elise at thinkglink.com. That's our Elise Glink. Nice to talk to you. Good to hear your voice again.
Oh, you too, John. Thank you.
Frequently on Mondays, we visit with Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Today's no exception. I hope you're doing well. How are you, Jim?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Doing great.
The whole host of interesting stories from you today, startups in the tech sector. I saw a picture of a robot that was working at a restaurant, and they were comparing it to how well the waiter did. You guys have been writing about that too, right?
Yeah, that's right. The company in the news this week is Grubhub, the Chicago-based food delivery company. They have a new food robot that is delivering grub to students on college campuses. So this is a new service that's now currently available at the University of Kentucky, University of Nevada, University of Las Vegas, and a handful of others, where they can deliver food to college students with their robot going about 4 miles an hour.
Okay, I saw that story too. I was thinking of a different one, but it was kind of funny because the picture I saw, here's the robot. It's this little machine with wheels, and it's going like on the walkway on campus by other college kids who are smiling, kind of looking at it. And I thought, there is food inside that little thing. And what college kid doesn't always want food? And that's, I guess, all of these kinds of food delivery services are sort of hanging on the fact that people will cooperate. They won't interfere. If it's a drone, if it's a robot, whatever, we're all kind of hoping that we all sort of get along, us and these machines, right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think the comparison I go back to often is that of Airbnb. You know, the idea of opening up your house to a stranger seemed crazy at the time, and that people would, you know, sort of grossly abuse that. But by and large, that hasn't happened. And I think what you're going to see is something similar with robots. I don't think the percentage of people kicking these things over will be incredibly high, although, of course, it's going to happen, certainly. And that'll be something that Grubhub and all these other companies are going to have to figure out. But, you know, what Grubhub really thinks is an opportunity here is, you know, college campuses, you know, especially big, large public universities, can be very difficult to reach from, you know, a food delivery standpoint, especially, you know, if you're in your dorm or at the library, you know, getting a delivery driver to sort of zip around through campus can be kind of challenging.
Yeah.
But this is where these robots can kind of come in handy.
So they're experimenting with it in Kentucky, Las Vegas, wherever. Is it going to come to the U of I, Northern Illinois? What do we know?
Yeah, they got a few different schools on the roadmaps. They're going to have 7 here up and running shortly. And so, you know, really the idea is to kind of expand this to as many, you know, colleges as they can. You know, it's interesting, though, because it comes at a time where some other of similar robot ventures are shutting down, actually. FedEx decided recently to step back from its R&D program, which offers a same-day delivery robot. Amazon itself, actually, is pulling back a bit from its plans to do the little robot sidewalk deliveries that they kind of touted some years ago. And so, you know, it'll be, you know, interesting to see how this industry plays out. But clearly Grubhub pushing forward as some other big players are pulling back.
Speaking of transportation stuff, what about Uber Freight? Tell us about that company.
Yeah, so Uber Freight, you know, its headquarters is here in Chicago. This is Uber's logistics arm that connects carriers with long-haul truckers. So they allow, you know, truckers to sort of sign up for shifts and to drive long-haul truck freights throughout the country. And, you know, the head of Uber Freight was just in town, you know, speaking at an event the other week here in Chicago at the Chicago Venture Summit. And, you know, it was interesting. He talked about how, you know, Chicago, of course, has always been the physical capital of logistics. And, you know, he really believes that Chicago can also be the digital capital of logistics. And so there's quite a bit of activity happening in Chicago's logistics tech sector. The number of local companies here that operate in this space doubled between 2019 and 2021, and seeing a lot of venture capital kind of flow into this. And so, you know, the industry itself is kind of going through a bit of a change, right? The average U.S. truck driver 20 years ago was 35. Today it's 55. So the industry itself is certainly getting older.
Two other companies I want you to talk a little bit about. Start with Workbox.
Yeah, Workbox is a co-working space that took an interesting twist recently. It opened a venture fund, so it's raised $15 million to invest in startups. So it's a co-working space that not only can offer startups a place to work, but also cash to grow their business, which I think is a really interesting business model. I would not be surprised if you start to see some other co-working spaces take a similar approach. So curious to see kind of where Workbox goes from here, but you know, the $15 million fund is going to invest in some areas like HR tech, financial tech, and property tech.
One other story I'm looking at buzzjournals.com right now is a startup to make water cleaner. Talk about this.
Yeah, this is a company called StemLoop, and they have basically created a home test that can detect lead in your drinking water. What's interesting here is the Chicago startup got backing from Titletown Tech. That's the venture capital fund from the Green Bay Packers. So the Packers set out a few years ago to launch a $25 million fund. They're raising another second fund at about $80 million. And so, yeah, the team up north is finding, you know, the Bears' hometown team to get an interesting startup investment as well.
Boy, you think the Detroit Lions would be behind it. I mean, the idea that some communities do not have clean water, including Dixon, Illinois. It's not always lead. Sometimes it is. But I would imagine that space could be pretty fertile, huh?
Huge space for these guys. I think that there's a lot of opportunity here. And clearly, you know, the Packers and you know, they see a big opportunity here to invest in StemLoop and kind of get this product off the ground. So, yeah, a company here really got kind of its start out of Northwestern University. And now with a little funding, we'll see where it can go from here.
Jim Dahlke, senior editor, ChicagoInno.com. Thanks, Jim. Let's talk next week.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's debt gets an upgrade from Fitch Ratings, the first in 12 years. The upgrade is from BBB- to BBB. Fitch says it made the move because of the city's improving pension funding practices and more conservative actions around maintaining reserves. City Hall estimates the ratings change will save $100 million in interest for every $1 billion borrowed. Chicago borrows between $1 and $2 billion annually. Fitch also says the outlook is positive on the bonds it rated, which means another upgrade coming in the next few years. Chicago's historic Ambassador Hotel is up for sale. Cranes reports Chinese investment firm Gaw Capital Partners put the 285-room hotel on the market, but no asking price is listed. It's located at 1301 North State Parkway. Goss spent millions upgrading the 17-story hotel, but then the pandemic hit. The report says the firm may have a hard time getting bids that exceed the $38.5 million mortgage on the property. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And now the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, and stay tuned if you're planning to make eyeballs and brains for your Halloween party. We're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. And the H in HD does not stand for
Halloween, Halloween, ooh, Halloween. Ghostly things are gonna happen.
Yes, one of the scariest times of the year, made even scarier by food poisoning.
You know, we think of scary as like goblins and monsters and things, but foodborne illness is also pretty scary and not something to really try and invite to your Halloween gathering this year.
Meredith Carruthers is a food and safety expert from the USDA's Meat and Poultry Hotline. And about the eyeballs and brains I mentioned earlier?
You know, one year I did spaghetti and meatballs, and we turned the meatballs into eyeballs. And so it looked really cool that way. It was almost like you're eating your face on spaghetti. But obviously we're cooking meatballs, so we needed to make sure that we were cooking them to a safe internal temperature.
And while killing a vampire may bring to mind a steak, the kind you drive with a hammer, or a silver bullet, the most important tool to shut down food poisoning in your eyeballs or other Halloween party tricks is a meat thermometer.
So if you're using ground beef or ground pork or ground lamb, you'll want them to be cooked to 160 degrees. If you're doing ground turkey or ground chicken, they need to be 165 degrees.
But where a lot of ghouls and boys get into trouble is food that's been sitting out at room temperature.
Bacteria will multiply to dangerous levels and scary levels if you leave those foods out for too long.
Yeah, too long is anything over 2 hours. Meanwhile, if you're bobbing for apples, there are some things to do to keep that water from becoming a pool of yucky bacteria. Also, stay away from unpasteurized ciders and juices, and no matter how tempting it may be, don't taste raw cookie dough or cake batter that contain uncooked eggs. For more info about food safety, the Meat and Poultry Hotline is 888-MP-HOTLINE, or you can go to foodsafety.gov. From the farm to your belly, today is National Baloney Day, and oh, it's National Food Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Bob Bland is the founder of a company called Life Quotes, and he joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Bob, welcome back to WGN. How are you today?
John, good afternoon. Doing great.
You have in the past said that life insurance, we do commercials for you, and we say this sometimes, that life insurance is less expensive now than it has been. It's historically inexpensive. Is that still true, given the economic climate we're in right now? Is life insurance still historically inexpensive?
As surprising as it sounds, yes. Right now, life insurance rates are at all-time lows, which is very surprising given the rise in death rates due to the COVID pandemic and due to the rising death rates outside of COVID that are most recently have been reported among working people. Who did not have COVID. In other words, they were not COVID-related deaths. So, yes, life insurance rates are currently at all-time lows. They've been dropping for over 10 years, and it's a great time to shop for life insurance.
Is that term or all kinds of life insurance?
Well, term leads the way there in terms of low price, and whole life rates and universal life rates are also low right now, lower than they've ever been. So all across the board, depending upon your needs.
Are people able to get out of an insurance policy? I mean, if I've already got an insurance policy, can I stop it and start a new one? How does that work?
Great question. And anyone that owns a life insurance policy should understand the way out, by the way. That's just common sense. Some life insurance policies in the early years have surrender penalties. Term insurance does not. You can drop it at any time. But whole life and universal life may have penalties in the early years. And by early years, I'm talking perhaps the first 7 years.
When you think of life insurance, you're thinking income replacement, right? Isn't that the object of the game?
Yes, the object of the game, especially with most parents, with moms and dads, the object of the game is to protect the family breadwinners against a catastrophic loss, of the breadwinner for the sake and safety of the children. Then later on, after the children have left and perhaps the mortgage is paid down or even paid off, life insurance, if you do your planning right over time, you should have a diminishing need for life insurance.
Right.
And some people will then want a permanent policy for their spouse. But yes, over time, you should have a diminishing need for life insurance.
A couple of our listeners are wondering, all right, what's the difference between whole and term? Give me the short answer to that, Bob.
The short answer is that term life covers you for death any death at any time in any place for a very specific period of time, which you'd agree to up front, which could be 10 years, 15, 20, 25, 30, or now even 40 years. Whereas, there is no cash value. So nothing happens unless you die. It's the cheapest kind of insurance per thousand. Then whole life is a policy that gives you level premiums, level coverage for life, and also has a cash value that starts building up, which you can borrow against later on. But whole life is more expensive because of the existence of that side fund or cash value.
Some people have those permanent products like whole life in their investment portfolio. Term insurance would never be that because if you stop paying on it, there's no money left in the bank. The only way you cash in on that is when you die, right?
Correct. I tend to advise people that never, ever think of term life as an investment. And at the outside, think of whole life and universal life as a possible investment or investment side benefit. But the overriding concern and attention should be given to the death protection of the policy.
So I've been saying lately, if you don't have insurance, you should get some now. And if you've already got insurance, you may be paying too much. Do you expect that this low that we're in right now is going to change? Are insurance rates going to go up?
Well, I'm not in the prediction business, and I've been wrong about this for years, but I do believe that they're going to bottom out and go up. Now, investment income, because of the rise in interest rates, insurance companies will now start to make more money like the old days in investment income. That will help keep rates low for a while. But right now, they are really low. A 50-year-old female could buy $500,000 of term life insurance and pay $33 a month now. So these are the lowest rates we've ever seen.
Hmm. All right. I just wanted to check in with you because it just seems like given the economy and how everything is getting more expensive, you were going to tell us, yeah, that's not true anymore. It's still true. We're still in this historically low period, huh?
We are. And I do believe it's a historical anomaly.
Hmm. How about that? Next time, we'll talk more about why that is. But at the end of the day, if you need insurance, this is the time to buy. Nice to talk to you again, Bob. He's with a company called LifeQuotes. LifeQuotes.com is their website. And we'll talk more again another day. Thanks for your help.
Thank you, John.